Well, do you feel these times of extremes? That's what we're talking with Greg Braden about, author of The Turning Point. And we'll come back with him in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie, Greg Braden with us. Greg, as you look at all of this, these extremes, what would you say might be the most important aspect of all of this right now?
The single aspect for me is the acknowledgement all of them are happening. I think it's easy, George, for us to get lost. You know, people are dedicating their lives to climate change or dedicating their lives to doing something about free energy, and I think all that's important. But that's why that quote is so important. We are synthesizers, and we're all trying to make sense of all of this. And I think the fact that all of them are converging, all of these extremes are converging into this narrow window of time. And to make sense of that, I think we've got to think differently than we ever have in the past. And that's why, you know, there's a part, the geologist in me says climate change is something we've really got to take a look at and what we're doing with that. And every day, the practical aspects of everyday life, that we've got to understand this new economy that's happening now. Then when I look at what's happening on a global level and the fact that energy is becoming so expensive that more and more people in the world can't afford to heat their homes and cook the meals and feed their children, how do you prioritize one over the other? It's all of them. I think what we're seeing, George, and I'm very passionate about this, you can tell that, is that this is the convergence of the unsustainable ways of thinking and living of 150 years of false science that are all showing up right now, and it's our opportunity to rethink the way that we've lived our lives in the past. And this is the good news. We've got the solutions out there. We have to have a reason to make the shift into those new solutions.
Well, and I think there's too much greed out there, Greg. That's a major problem here, don't you think?
Well, this is absolutely there. When people ask me, you know, I do live programs through translators all over the world, and I say, okay, here's the good news. The best science of our time is revealed these facts, and people stand up in the audience, and they're it's a standing ovation. They're applauding, and then the next question is, why aren't we seeing this in the mainstream media, mainstream documentaries, mainstream classrooms, mainstream textbooks? And the answer is what you just shared, George. It's power, ego, greed, habit. All of those things have come together, and that's all part of the normalcy bias. I think it's. I've had college professors say to me, Greg, do you have any idea how much money it would cost to change Darwin's theory of evolution in the textbooks? Or they have said to me, Greg, I have taught Darwin's theory of evolution in college-level classrooms for 40 years. For me to share new discoveries would invalidate what I have done for 40 years. Now, I don't think that's true. I think science is a way of knowing that is designed to serve us, and it can only serve us if we keep it honest. And science is designed to be constantly updated when new discoveries tell us something one year that we didn't know the year before. And I think to honor our young people, we have now an entire generation of young people. We're asking them to solve some of the greatest crises and the greatest extremes of 5,000 years of human history, and we're asking them to solve the problems with the same thinking that led to the problems. We're not honoring them with the new discoveries. And I'm not suggesting we throw everything, the baby out with the bathwater, that we revamp the entire curricula. What I am suggesting is I think the honoring thing to do is to share the new discoveries with our young people alongside the existing theories so that they know that the information is still forthcoming. They know they're still part of making the discoveries that can change the world. We've done pilot programs, middle school, elementary school, and I just spoke with 1,750 high school seniors for a senior seminar.
And do they get it, Greg?
8:30 in the morning till 2:30 in the afternoon. And the most exciting thing for them, George, was the knowing that they can still play a part in making discoveries that will heal the world. That was exciting to them. It's not exciting for them to know that everything is set in stone, all the discoveries have been made, and that they have limited options. That's where they lose interest. But when they know that new discoveries are still being made, Göbekli Tepe, a peer-reviewed archaeological site in Turkey, is now pushing technologically advanced civilizations back into the last ice age 13,000 years ago. That changes everything those young people have been told about history, and now they're excited to know what happened between then and now. What else have we missed? That's just one example. So the ideas of climate change. Can we just take a moment and talk?
And by the way, you do know I believe that we're in an Earth cycle, that it's not generally man-created, but that's me.
Well, I think what we're looking at, in all honesty, George, is we are looking at a natural cycle. That's true. And I think we're also looking at human-created conditions, but the two, I think, are separate issues. And here's what I mean by this. We're all being told that the greenhouse gases are the problem, that they're causing the climate change.
And the result of man, which
and the result of man, and we're being told it's an open and shut case. The consensus is so clear that their mainstream media has said they're no longer even entertaining any other new theories. That just happened at the end of this last year. If we're going to be honest with ourselves, and I'm a geologist, so this is my lens into the past, we owe it to ourselves. We've got to answer four big questions. And it's not about making anybody right or wrong or anything like that. We've got one chance to get this right, George. And if we cannot answer these questions, then we're preparing for the wrong thing. Four big questions. Number one, the question is, why did the warming actually stop 17 years ago? Earth Systems Science Center, University of Alabama, is very clear. We haven't seen that global warming since 97. Number two, why is the ice accumulating and building in Antarctica more and faster now than it was 50 years ago when the theory says it should be disappearing? The Journal of Geophysical Research, June 2013, is telling us that. Here's a big one for me. I've studied the ice cores as a geologist from Vostok, Antarctica. And what's called the inconvenient data.
Well, that's a great place to discover stuff, though, isn't it?
It really is. We could spend a whole program on the archaeological sites that are being found there, the geologic sites. But listen to this, George. What the ice cores are showing is that for the last 800,000 years, the temperatures of the Earth rise before the greenhouse gases rise.
That's right.
And if that's the case, it means the greenhouse gas cannot be the cause of the temperature increasing. And if our listeners, if you've never heard this before, the very prestigious journal Nature, volume 329, October 1987, this is before it became political. Scientists knew this. 1987, page 414 to 418. There's a lag time of about 400 to 800 years between the time the temperature increases and when the greenhouse gases increase. And there's also the number four here. This is the last one. Why is it that we've seen the temperatures in the last 2,000 years? Now, this isn't during the time of the dinosaurs. This is during the time of the Bronze Age and the time of when Jesus walked the earth. The last 2,000 years, why has the temperature been three times as high in the last 2,000 years as it is right now, but the CO2 levels weren't there to trigger those temperatures? So are the CO2 levels high now? The answer is absolutely yes. They're at record. We haven't seen it this high for 600,000 years. Should we lower them? It's probably a good idea to lower them. But to tell people that if we change light bulbs and drive different cars, we're going to stop and reverse climate change doesn't give people an opportunity to prepare and adapt to the new normal of climate, and I think that is the disservice. We're not adapting to the cycle that we're now moving into. And so people say, well, if these things aren't the cause, what is causing the climate change? And there's scientists have known this since the 70s. There's a very interesting study, Proceedings, National Academy of Sciences, November 7th, the year 2000, volume 97. The bottom line is the output from the sun is the factor that's being overlooked. And a lot of the climate studies that won't even talk about it, George. They won't even talk about it. But we're looking at solar cycles that they are 10,000-year cycles. They're 5,000-year cycles, 41,000-year cycles. They're 100,000, 100,000, 41, 26, and 5,000-year cycles.
But these are extremes. But, you know, as we just have talked about, mankind really isn't creating these extremes. So what is? What's out there in the universe that's doing this?
The studies suggest, George, it's our relationship to the sun. Earth, and when I was a kid, I used to think that the energy that we receive from I was born and raised in Missouri, and I used to think every
whereabouts?
Kansas City, Missouri.
Okay,
are you a Missouri?
Detroit, but spent a lot of time in St. Louis.
Well, I was born and raised in Missouri, very conservative, Midwestern thinking.
And if you don't like the weather, wait a minute, it'll change.
That's right. But it was change within certain constants. And I think all of us here in the desert Southwest, we're accustomed to thinking of weather happening on a very cyclic, very regular basis, and it's never going to change. And the fact is that Earth's relationship to the sun in space changes on a rhythmic basis, but the changes are so far and few between. Nobody living now remembers the last time this happened. Our ancestors wrote about it, and it's in the geologic record that is not being acknowledged, in my opinion. It's not being acknowledged in a truthful, factual, honest way in the studies that are telling people, the mainstream, what's happening with climate. But what we see is 100,000-year cycles. We see obvious cycles of warming and cooling. And then there's cycles within cycles, George. It kind of looks like a bad day on the stock market, up and down. We see 41,000-year cycles, 26,000-year cycles. And these we are in a warming cycle right now. We should be. I'd be concerned if we weren't. The question is how warm.
But there's nothing we can do about it. You really can't.
In the past, George, they were intense. They're brief. And it's what comes after the warming that's a bigger problem than the warming. It's the cooling cycle that affects the northern hemisphere, where most of the landmass is, where most people live, and where most of our food is grown. That is the problem. And my concern is that people act surprised every time there's a big storm or a flood, and they're saying, okay, climate change, and we humans did it. And then they act surprised when the same thing happens again the next year. We are in a time of extremes when we can expect disruptions in service during certain times of the year. It makes sense to adapt to that. Where we can expect disruptions in power, we can expect disruptions in the way food is delivered to our grocery stores. But if we acknowledge the extremes, the existence of the extremes, then we factor that into the way we live our lives, and we're not caught off guard. We become resilient to those extremes, and they don't have the devastating impact that they can have. This is one example of community resilience.
Well,
so it's interesting to me to see. We talked in the first segment about the new normal, and it's interesting to see how people, politicians or academics or people in the business community, make the promises of returning to the normal that we knew 5, 10, 15 years ago, including with climate, when the data simply suggests that we cannot go back because of where we are in the cycle that we're emerging in right now. And the best science of our time, we keep hearing there's a scientific consensus, and there may be a consensus among a select number of papers that have been chosen to study, but there is not a consensus among mainstream scientists. I don't know, can I share just some other opinions? Can I do this on the air?
In terms of what?
Well, you know, we hear that there's a consensus, and it's an open and shut case. My mom and I have this conversation. She said, you know, what are you talking about? It's a done deal. And I said, well, it's not, Mom. And I'd like to give some of the leading scientists from very esteemed academic institutions, their message simply is not being carried in the mainstream media. So I just a couple of those I'd like to share with our listeners so they get an idea. Sally Bolinas, for example, astronomer, Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics, says, quote, the recent warming trend in surface temperature cannot be caused by the increase of human-made greenhouse gases in the air. That's a quote. David Douglas, professor, Department of Physics, Astronomy, University of Rochester, says the pattern of warming that we're seeing now doesn't show the characteristic fingerprint of greenhouse warming. We would expect it to look different. And last one, William Gray, Professor Emeritus, head of the Tropical Meteorology Project, Department of Atmospheric Science, Colorado State University, he said the warming is likely a result of natural alterations in global ocean currents.
But those people will never get the publicity on mainstream media.
Well, they don't, but the point that I'm making here, again, it's not about making anyone right or wrong or anything. We've gone beyond that. Our world is changing, and climate is one facet of the extremes, along with the economy, along with energy, that's affecting all of us. And unless we embrace the fact of the change, the new normal that's emerging, and adapt to it so that we can create the resilience and actually thrive, we can thrive in these extremes if we make room for them and factor them into our lives. Otherwise, we are caught clinging to this idea of what normal looks like, and then every time something beyond that normal shows up in our lives, every time we get a flood in Colorado or a big hurricane off the East Coast or the drought, you know, in the Southwest or whatever it is, we're blaming one another. And rather than adapting to that extreme, which is going to be with us at least for the rest of our lifetime, George, we're acting like we were caught off guard. And a social factor that I didn't expect is actually emerging from this as well, and that is that members of families, neighbors, next-door neighbors, and communities are actually now being pitted against one another because of their differing beliefs in climate change and the way they live their lives. So if somebody drives one kind of a car and someone drives another kind of a car, or if someone's using one kind of light bulbs or whatever, it's actually causing problems on that level in neighborhoods, a lot of judgment, a lot of criticism. And I've had people come up to me in Western Europe. They're in tears. They feel so guilty that somehow they have contributed to the horrible changes that are affecting so many people's lives and devastating cities along the coastlines.
That's not their fault.
Yeah, it goes on and on. This is just one facet. So I don't think we have all the answers. And I think we're probably looking at two separate problems. CO2 levels are high. I think it's good to bring them down, and we have the technology to do that. And we definitely have to get off fossil fuels. I'm all about that.
Well, I think a lot of people, Greg, confuse climate change with pollution. And, you know, who's in favor of pollution? You know?
Yeah. Absolutely. I know you've had other guests that have talked about this and had these conversations as well. But what's interesting is even the models, George, that have been used over these last 8 or 10 years, the climate change models, that we're basing all of this information and the predictions for our future upon, those models cannot even tell us what has already happened after it happened when we factor that into the model. So it tells us that there's something we don't know, something that's being left out. We've got to answer those four questions. You know, why would the temperatures rise before the gases? That means the gas isn't causing the rise. If it's not, we've got to get real about what is, and we've got to get real about those changes, adapting those changes in our lives. And it ties into the economy. We could put people to work making the changes to adapt to this climate, burying power and communication cables, for example, decentralizing power, building alternative localized sources of power in communities so that they're not so affected when those power shortages happen.
Well, and wait till the grid goes down. One day it'll happen.
Well, exactly. And it's happened in other countries. We all saw the big one in India that was last in 2020.
Yeah, Canada's had it as well. Greg, stay with us. We're going to come back in a moment. Greg Braden's website, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. The Turning Point. Greg Braden, our guest. I'm George Norrie, and we shall, of course, be back in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. We'll take your calls, and Greg Braden's with us next hour as well. Greg, so the title of the book, of course, The Turning Point. Tell us what you mean by that.
The turning point is nature's way of allowing us to chart a new course, a new path, when we are all so familiar with the tipping points, the very frightening tipping points that we've heard about in the media, and the experts are very, very good at telling us about frightening tipping points of climate change, like we've been talking about, or or when the debt of the world is so great the economy collapses and things like that. What they don't tell us, George, is that before you ever reach those frightening tipping points, you must pass through at least one turning point. The turning point is, it is nature's way of allowing us to shift our course, to set a new course when we have the wisdom to embrace them. A turning point can be a source of knowledge. It can be a discovery. It can be a direct experience that changes the way we think about ourselves and our relationship to the world. So the discovery of DNA, for example, that was a turning point in our global thinking in terms of our relationship to our bodies and the code in our bodies. The discovery I mentioned earlier, Göbekli Tepe, a technologically advanced civilization in the last ice age, that is a piece of knowledge that now changes the way we think about ourselves and our relationship to the past. The landing on the moon, I remember in 1969, I remember it very well. Or the election of Barack Obama, the first black president and elected to the United States of America. These are experiences. We experienced that moon landing, and we saw it in our little black and white TVs, and we experienced that inauguration, and it changed the way we feel about our relationship to the world. So these are examples of turning points. And the fact that we're living a time of extremes, creating this new normal, is a turning point unto itself. Our ability to embrace the opportunities and literally to thrive in the new world that's emerging, it hinges upon our willingness to be honest with ourselves about the facts. We've just shared some with the climate change, with the economy, other things that we've talked about in the past, the energy of the world and where that's coming from, for example. These are all contributing to a turning point that is upon us. It's not like it's going to happen, you know, down the road somewhere. It's here right now. And our willingness to embrace these and to change the way we think and live creates the resilience that becomes the turning point in our lives. And that's why I'm so optimistic. This is the generation where these changes are all now up for us. They're up for grabs. Everything is up for grabs because this new normal is emerging. And it's the evolutionary biologists have always said that crisis is a trigger for evolution, and I think that is the role that the extremes are playing in our lives right now, because the extremes are creating a rebalancing for the unsustainable ways of thinking and living that have led to this point. It's interesting, George, I looked at your list of guests, and so many of your guests in the past as well as in the future, they're all addressing facets of this rebalancing that all fall under the umbrella of precisely what we're talking about right now.
When you talk about, of course, we're going to be okay, that doesn't mean it's not going to be a bumpy road, though, right?
I think it's all about where our perspective is, George. And you asked me before the break what I think is the biggest crisis, and my answer was that all of them together are creating opportunity. I think the one that people are probably going to notice the quickest is going to be the changes in the economy, because the economy affects all of our lives. And it's, you know, it's interesting to me when I say with a live audience, often when I say the word economy, you see people's eyes kind of glaze over because they think it's going to be technical, boring, and all about money. And while it can be about money, the economy is about much more than money. It's about us and the way we treat one another and how we share vital resources like food and energy and medicine, and how we help one another as we go through the extremes. I've been to places where they have very viable economies and they don't use money at all. So it can be about money, but it doesn't have to be. It's more about the ideas underlying how we work together.
If you could change one thing, Greg, one thing, what would it be?
If I could change one thing?
Yep, just with a swing of a magic wand.
You know what I would do, George? It's a beautiful question, and I just had this conversation with a dear friend of mine, Dr. Bruce Lipton, who I think has been on your show as well.
Sure has, absolutely.
I would share the new discoveries of nature's cooperation in the classrooms of the world, and I would share it in every outlet and every news media to to inform people that we live in a world that is literally based in what biologists call mutual aid and cooperation. And the farther we stray, the more conflict we see, the more we hurt one another, the farther we stray from the truest laws of nature and our deepest relationship with nature itself. And I think it's a place to begin, because so many people, we have an entire generation of young people who are now steeped in the belief that war is the way to solve our problems, and this wartime mentality is so prevalent among not just Western civilizations. I've seen it all over the world now. And I think it's going to take another generation to come back to acknowledging that while war is a fact, and it is a factor, it doesn't have to be the dominant factor in terms of the way we think and live and solve our problems.
Well, you know, Greg, I'm going to, in a moment, I'm going to let you listen to a clip from one of my favorite movies. Mm-hmm. And I want you to react to that, because I think that's exactly where you've been headed and what you've been saying. And so listen to this clip, and then let's get your take on it. I've never talked to you about this.
I don't have to tell you things are bad. Everybody knows things are bad. It's a depression. Everybody's out of work or scared of losing their job. The dollar buys a nickel's worth. Banks are going bust. Shopkeepers keep a gun under the counter. Punks are running wild in the street. There's nobody anywhere who seems to know what to do, and there's no end to it. We know the air is unfit to breathe and our food is unfit to eat. We sit watching our TVs while some local newscaster tells us that today we had 15 homicides and 63 violent crimes, as if that's the way it's supposed to be. We know things are bad, worse than bad. They're crazy. It's like everything everywhere is going crazy, so we don't go out anymore. We sit in the house, and slowly the world we're living in is getting smaller, and all we say is, please, at least leave us alone in our living rooms. Let me have my toaster and my TV and my steel-belted radios, and I won't say anything. Just leave us alone. Well, I'm not going to leave you alone. I want you to get mad. I don't want you to protest. I don't want you to riot. I don't want you to write to your congressman, because I wouldn't know what to tell you to write. I don't know what to do about the depression and the inflation and the Russians and the crime in the street. All I know is that first, you've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm a human being. My life has value. So I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
What do you think of that, Mr. Braden?
Well, I've heard the last two sentences every time we've been together on a panel at the Conscious Life Expo.
That's right.
And you'll hear I hadn't heard what happened before that. I hadn't heard that.
it's spot on, isn't it?
Well, I know our listeners have heard history repeats itself. And as a student of cycles, and I believe strongly in patterns of energy. Those patterns can be on a cosmic level. They can be on a planetary level. Earth's relationship to the sun changing the climate is a good example of that. It can be on an economic level. And this is where we are, and I don't want to be redundant with anything from a previous guest, but it's interesting. If you look at the global economy, the parallels between the years 1937 and 1942 and 2008 and 2013, you can't miss them, George. They're very clear for all of us to see. It doesn't mean we have to have the same outcomes, but the history is repeating itself and the cycles are repeating. And the question is, will we have the wisdom to recognize where we are in the cycles and to embrace the opportunities? Will we embrace the turning points of change that allow us to thrive this time around, or are we going to revert to the fear and the normalcy bias that denies the existence of these facts and fall prey to the frightening outcomes that we've seen in the past? I don't know the answer to that. I'm an optimist by nature, but I mentioned I'm also a realist. We've got to get real among ourselves, and I think the media plays a huge role in this. Honor us with the facts. That's all I think people want, the facts of the economy.
That's it. Just the truth.
Absolutely. In a truthful, honest, factual way without the spin of making it support a political party or a political agenda or an economic agenda. Just tell us what's happening. In my experience, whether I'm working with indigenous people in the Andes of Bolivia or Peru, or the monks and the nuns in Tibet or here in the native Southwest or wherever it is, when the facts are clear, then the choices for the best outcome become obvious. We don't need to be told what to do. But being told without it making any sense, when we don't have those facts, that's where people, I think, really begin to struggle. And what I know, I work for the government and the defense industry long enough. When I see something that makes no sense to me, what I know is I don't have all the facts. And maybe sometimes I don't need them. I don't know. But when I see something that makes no sense, I know I don't have all the facts. And what I see happening with the economy is a big part of that. I don't have all the facts, but what I see happening, I know that we could stop it in a heartbeat. But we're not stopping it. And it leads me to believe we're probably moving toward a very different kind of economy. And again, I think some of your other guests probably talked about it. But, you know, the interesting thing, I spend a lot of time in Europe, George, and I hear things in Zurich, Switzerland, for example, financial capital of the world mm-hmm. in some respects. I was there during, I think it was the G8 summit. It was happening in 2009. And there was conversation on the streets, the cafes, you know, the restaurants in Zurich, and I called here back the States. Nobody knew the topic that everybody over there was talking about. That day in 2009, the members of the G8 had announced a new currency, a new world currency, and they'd actually shown, held up for the press, the coins for this currency.
They were ready to go.
And I'm not saying it's going to happen in that way, but the coin, it actually said unity and diversity on one side, and it said future world currency on the other side. And the fact that they would even mention it in the media tells me that at least it's on the radar. And I wouldn't be surprised to see the currencies of the world that are being devalued so quickly, the debt of the world that is being increased so quickly that it can't be paid off. It may be a way to go about addressing that, is to create a new currency. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? I don't know. I think it's all about how it's done. It's all about the thinking underlying it and how it's done. But the fact that in 2009 the G8 said that they were even considering it tells me that that's something that's a factor of where we're going with all of this now. So all of these things together, just if we could just know where the facts are leading and allow us to make the changes in our personal lives, in our families, in our communities, to adapt to these changes in a healthy, life-affirming way, I think that would be a way to honor us as we go through these changes.
All right, let's take some calls, and then we'll take a full hour of calls with you next hour.
Sure.
Philadelphia we go. Hello, Dennis. You're on with Greg Braden.
Oh, hi, gentlemen. How are you?
Good.
Hey, Dennis. Good to hear your voice.
You know, it seems to me that, I don't know, I'm not making any accusations or anything like this, but it seems to me that what you are doing here and what I have been doing, and I speak about this every single day to friends of mine, that what you're actually describing on how unnatural the way people are living today, the way they're treating each other, the way they're treating the earth, the political system itself is so, it's so unnatural, narcissistic, it is so sociopathic, is that what we're actually doing here is questioning the very economic system that we are living under. I mean, what can you actually say about an economic system where right now we're having flaring taking place? That's where they are burning off an excess amount of gas. It has too much. Meanwhile, people in Detroit are freezing to death. They're having their gas shut off because they can't afford to pay, which is what this whole economic system is based around. If you can't afford to pay, well, then you die. If you can't afford to eat and buy food, well, then you starve. If you can't afford to pay your rent or pay your mortgage, you're thrown out onto the street and you die from the elements. Okay? Or it's profitable to poison the air and poison the ground and poison the water. Why? Well, if you fine them for doing this and they've said this in the past. Well, it's best.
Dennis, are you asking me? I'm hearing everything you're saying. Are you asking me what I think about it, or are you?
I'm saying a lot of people do this. You know, they talk about the defects in this economic system and how it has actually outlived its usefulness, and it's now becoming a hindrance to survival than anything else. But they're afraid to actually question the economic system itself and say capitalism, because they're afraid of being attacked by the flag wavers and called unpatriotic and so forth.
Absolutely. Well, this is part of the normalcy bias that we've talked about throughout this program. They don't like what's happening, and they don't know what else to do in place of it. What I'm seeing is that it's not happening in a vacuum, Dennis. The economic system isn't happening in a vacuum. It's because of the extremes in climate, because of the extremes and some of the other things that we've talked about, that I believe we will see that the need for cooperation will become greater than the fear of the system that we're using now. And in that's the blessing. That's where the opening comes in that makes room for the new forms of energy, for example, that are not based in fossil fuels. We already have them. They're simply not embraced in the world right now. So it's the crises themselves, the extremes leading to the crises, that create the opening that makes room for the new world that I know you know is possible, that so many of us have talked about for so very long. The question is, does it happen all at once, or is it phased in? Is it a gradual phasing? And I don't know the answer to that, but what I'm seeing is I wouldn't be surprised to see a new monetary system sometime in the next couple of years. On a global basis, and I'm already seeing, a lot of our listeners may not have heard this, but oil is becoming a thing in the past. So we're now moving beyond the age of oil into liquefied natural gas, which is, it's not the solution, it's a step in the right direction. It's 50% cleaner, it's a lot less expensive. It's a stepping stone to get us to the energy systems that will require no combustion whatsoever.
Greg, we're going to come back and take a final hour of phone calls with you as we talk about the turning point on Coast to Coast AM.